Press TV headlines, Israel keeps pounding the besieged Gaza Strip. At least 35 Palestinians, including 12 children, have been killed in the strike since Monday. The Israeli army says Palestinians have fired more than 1,000 rockets towards Israel since Monday evening. And international condemnations pour in over the Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip and in Jerusalem. Al-Quds. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Israel has carried out more airstrikes on the Gaza Strip amid rising tensions in the region. Israeli jets bombed several targets, including a police headquarters and training centers of resistance movement Hamas. The attack comes after Hamas targeted Tel Aviv and the town of Beersheba with more than 200 rockets last night. Hamas says the salvo was in response to Israeli airstrikes on Gaza. The retaliatory attacks targeted an energy pipeline between the cities of Eilat and Ashkelon. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh has declared that the resistance front will remain steadfast in its fight against Israeli crimes.
If they want to escalate, the resistance is ready. If they want to stop, the resistance is ready. If they want to move their hand out of Jerusalem al-Quds, the resistance is ready. This is the message that we deliver to all the sides and to whoever is involved.
Haniyeh said Palestinians will never leave al-Quds alone and will continue to fight to protect the city from Israeli forces. The Israeli military says over 1,000 rockets have been fired from Gaza since Monday after Israel launched airstrikes on the enclave. Israel has threatened that it will continue its attacks. Israeli aggression has already left at least 35 Palestinians dead, including 12 children and 3 women. Scores of others have been wounded.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held funerals for civilians killed in Israeli airstrikes that targeted residential areas in different parts of the enclave. The Israeli army launched the attacks on the Gaza Strip on Monday. Children are also among the victims.
My relatives were playing next to their home and the Israeli airplanes hit them and killed some of them. We are really sad, but we are ready to sacrifice anything for Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's our right and we are going to grab it from Israel by force, even if we die defending Palestine. We ask the resistance to respond.
God is greater than Israel. I lost my little son while my husband lost his legs. I'm totally speechless and I can't believe this till this moment.
The ongoing wave of violence broke out on Monday after Hamas issued an ultimatum demanding Israel remove its forces from Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The Israeli airstrikes came after resistance groups in the Gaza Strip conducted rocket attacks against Israel.
Palestinian resistance will keep defending Palestinians with all means. What is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds is a crime, and the Israeli regime should get the punishment from Palestinians for attacking worshippers in holy places. Israeli regime is practicing terrorism policies in Jerusalem al-Quds and the Gaza Strip.
Palestinians have gathered here to mourn some of those who were killed in Israeli raids. As Israel keeps bombing and killing Palestinians, people here call on the international community to confront the Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Well, this just in, another Palestinian has been killed in Israeli attacks on Gaza. The death toll has now risen to 36. We're going to keep you posted on the details of that story and much more as we get it for you right here on Press TV. Well, Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian protesters across the West Bank amid escalating tensions in the occupied territories. In Ramallah, Israeli troops fired tear gas to disperse the Palestinian protesters who hurled rocks and burnt fires. One Palestinian was killed in the clashes there. Similar clashes happened in Nablus and several other cities across the occupied land. At least three people have so far been killed in the clashes. The unrest comes as Israel is pushing ahead with a heavy-handed crackdown on Palestinians in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. The tensions escalated after Israeli troops launched crackdown against Palestinian worshippers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque on Friday, which marked International Al-Quds Day. Analyst and activist Abbas Hamida says Palestinians have the right to resist and defend their homeland.
Well, I believe the Palestinian resistance is at a stage where it's fed up over a decade of besiegement in the Gaza Strip. The Zionist regime is continuously attacking the Palestinian people on the ground throughout Palestine. Lately, in specific to the area in Jerusalem called Sheikh Jarrah, where they're trying to forcefully evacuate the Palestinians and annex their homes to replace them with illegal Jewish settlers. Palestinian resistance is basically left with no options. Their people are being attacked, and let's face it, you know, according to international law, the Palestinians have a right to resist. You know, be it Hamas or be it any other movement in Palestine that's, you know, there to defend the Palestinian people. They are there to defend their homeland from the aggressors. Israel is an illegal occupier in Palestine, and the Palestinians have a right to resist. You know, international law allows them for that as well.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has condemned Israeli violence against Palestinians in occupied Jerusalem. Al-Quds, Rouhani described the incidents in the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound during the fasting month of Ramadan as bitter and ominous. He voiced Iran's support for Palestinians and urged them to keep up their resistance. The rising escalation of violence in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, prompted international reactions. The United Nations warned of a full-scale war. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he's working with all relevant parties for urgent de-escalation. The Arab League condemned the airstrikes on Gaza as indiscriminate and irresponsible. The African Union also denounced the raids. Amnesty International accused Israel of using unlawful and abusive force against Palestinians. People have rallied in several cities across the world to condemn Israel's crackdown on Palestinian protesters in the West Bank and its aggression against the Gaza Strip.
Under brutal subjugation from the occupation and the pointless acts of terrorism perpetrated by the Israeli military.
In New York City, thousands of protesters gathered outside the Israeli consulate. A similar gathering was held outside the U.S. State Department in support of Palestinians. The protesters condemned Washington's silence on Israeli crimes. Protesters in the Turkish city of Istanbul held a rally in front of the Israeli consulate for a third night in a row. They called on Ankara to sever ties with Tel Aviv. In Kuwait City, demonstrators voiced their solidarity with the beleaguered people in the Gaza Strip and against the eviction of Palestinians from their homes in a Jerusalem Al-Quds neighborhood. Marchers in central London called for an end to Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. South Africans have held protests across the country to condemn their government's slow action in boycotting Israel amid the regime's ongoing assault on Palestinians. Hassan Seri reports from Cape Town.
The escalation of the Israeli aggression against the Palestinian people is awakening the people of the world to the true face of the regime and prompting people from all walks of life to emerge and raise their voices.
The women and the children, we all know, is disproportionately impacted by the violence that is happening in the Al-Aqsa. And I think as women that we need to be able to stand with those women in solidarity, and that is why I'm here today.
I think the atrocities of the Al-Aqsa Mosque or a demonstration of insecurity and of awareness that the light at the end of the tunnel. For Israel, for Zionist state, is an oncoming train. For us, it's the daylight. The next phase in the struggle is drawing to an end.
South Africans have always highlighted the plight of Palestinians, with numerous marches held to demand a stronger action from the government. While the ruling ANC has taken several policy decisions in this regard, it has largely failed to sign them into law. However, lobbyists are expected to put forward a bill in Parliament that will seek a boycott of Israel.
We want Parliament to discuss it as soon as possible and to adopt laws which will force everyone in South Africa, big business, universities, sports bodies, to have nothing to do with Israel.
The South African government has condemned the Israeli forces' raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and the planned evictions in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds. It slammed the move as being in breach of international law and several UN Security Council resolutions. But the country is yet to indicate any plan to downscale ties with Tel Aviv. The demonstration year forms part of a national day of action in which sister protests have taken place in Johannesburg, Durban, and other parts of the country. Protesters say they will continue their action until the government takes decisive steps. Hassan Siriep, Cape Town.
The second day of registration for the potential candidates for Iran's upcoming presidential election is underway. The registration kicked off at the Interior Ministry building on Tuesday and will run until Saturday. Former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was the most prominent figure to register on Wednesday. A series of other notable officials have so far handed over their documents at the ministry building. Those names include Said Mohammed, who previously served as the commander of a major construction base, and Hossein Dehghan, the former defense minister of President Hassan Rouhani's cabinet. Iranians will go to the polls on 18th of June to choose a successor to the incumbent President Hassan Rouhani.
Iran, Tehran, the Interior Ministry, the elections office of the country, which is now registering the hopefuls for the upcoming June presidential elections. Over 20 public figures have officially announced their intention to run for president, but the final list of candidates will be announced by the Constitution Council on May 27th. This man was the first luminary showing up, Mohammad Hassan Nami, an army general who ministered telecoms during President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He told at a brief presser that he has tens of plans for the country's future, especially in the economic fields.
I have 62 programs for my administration when I would be elected. The main six ones will be performed within the first 6 months of my term. It mainly focuses on improving the life quality of people, especially in economic terms.
The next salient figure who signed up on the first day was Said Mohammed, another man with military backgrounds who has served as the commander of the IRGC's construction base.
My likely government will certainly abide by the agreements reached by the incumbent administration. So as the 2015 nuclear deal is an international deal, we will comply with our commitments. This is the other side that has withdrawn from the pact unilaterally.
The third one was the former defense minister of President Hassan Rouhani, who is now serving as an advisor to the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Particularly with regard to the public livelihood, people's livelihood. Well, that has so much details, but within 2 years, I will be in contact with different associations, guilds, and the university professors. I have had face-to-face talks with them in the past 2 years, and that has been delineated on the basis of the facts and realities in the society.
Apart from these three, Wahab Azizi, Secretary General of Jihad Garan Party, and Mohammad Zarif Fumani, Secretary General of Popular Party of Reforms, appeared to announce their bid. Some top political figures are also seen as possible presidential hopefuls, but they have not declared their decision yet. They include former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, Judiciary Chief Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi, current Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, and Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. The new interpretation of the Constitutional Council of the Election Law says that runners must be between 40 and 75 years of age with at least 4 years of managerial experience with no criminal records. This as the former military personnel must have served as major general. With these conditions in, several of the current hopefuls may be out of the race. Human Abedi, Tehran.
India has hit a record death toll, registering over 4,200 COVID-19 fatalities in a single day. The new deaths over the past 24 hours have taken India's overall toll to more than 250,000. Since the start of the pandemic, daily infection cases have also risen by almost 350,000. The figure has brought the country's caseload to nearly 23.3 million. India is grappling with a severe health crisis caused by a COVID surge in the past several weeks. The surge is partly blamed on a new strain which the World Health Organization has classified as a variant of global concern. The coronavirus pandemic is surging across Europe, with several countries reporting more deaths and infections. Italy registered 251 new deaths, while the number of infections there rose by nearly 7,000. The country has so far registered more than 123,000 deaths and over 4.1 million infections. Meanwhile, France reported 236 hospital deaths in one day, as more than 4,700 COVID patients remain in intensive care units. Elsewhere in Europe, the UK posted another 20 deaths and over 2,000 new daily cases. Germany also registered more than 6,100 new coronavirus cases, pushing its overall caseload to over 3.5 million. The country's total death toll now stands at above 85,000, with 283 new fatalities in the past 24 hours. The European Union's Brexit negotiator has warned Britain to fully apply the terms of its departure from the bloc or risk losing credibility on the global stage. Michel Barnier said Britain is not doing its commitments on fishing and Northern Ireland. He urged London to respect the Brexit terms on those two crucial issues approved in the two agreements in 2019 and 2020. The EU has already launched legal proceedings against Britain over a unilateral six-month delay on imposing customs controls on goods arriving in Northern Ireland from Britain. Tensions have also flared last week over fishing when French boats massed at the Channel Island of Jersey, claiming they were being denied licenses to fish off its shores despite a Brexit pledge of continued access. That's a wrap for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
The Biden administration gives lip service to a negotiated settlement, but Washington has done nothing at all to prevent the gradual colonization of the Palestinian West Bank, says Juan Kohlreiter in an article titled, "By supporting Trump's move of the U.S. Embassy to Al-Quds, Biden enabled Israeli ethnic cleansing of Palestinians." Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime has approved 450 housing units in Har Homa district in the east of Al-Quds. The planning of more and more squatter settlements on land owned by Palestinian families is among the actions that produced massive unrest in Al-Quds recently. In particular, the Israeli regime plan to make dozens of families homeless in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood has raised tensions to a fever pitch. The Israeli regime pretends not to recognize the property titles of many families there and prevents them from making additions to their homes. When they do so anyway, the Israelis schedule them for demolition. This behavior is among the reasons that Human Rights Watch has just branded the fake regime of Israel as an apartheid regime. There were further Palestinian protests recently in Al-Quds as far-right wing groups, the Israeli equivalent of QAnon, plan to parade through Palestinian neighborhoods waving Israeli regime flags just to make it clear who is in control of people's lives there. Palestinians are not allowed to protest, and the Israeli commandos come in to break heads and throw stun grenades. For a Palestinian who wave a Palestinian flag, this is a crime that could result in long years in jail. This is what the U.S. press calls clashes and skirmishes, managing to avoid naming Israeli regime repression. Since the Israeli regime is unimpeded in building throughout the West Bank, 60% of which is under direct Israeli regime military occupation, and 40% of which is under indirect Israeli regime military occupation, no two-state solution has been plausible for at least a decade, and maybe more. Speaking of two states that can never materialize is just a way of, in Mitt Romney's words, kicking the can down the road. So the new construction in Palestinian East Al-Quds was denounced by Washington, but the denunciation is toothless. Netanyahu knows that it is toothless and engaged in one of his favorite sports, owning the libs in Washington. Al-Quds, he said, is not a settlement, it is the capital of Israel, he claimed. The Biden administration says that the ultimate disposition of East Al-Quds is a matter for final status negotiations between Israel and Palestinians. But Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken don't have a leg to stand on in rejecting Netanyahu's position, since they decided to ratify the decision of the odious Trump to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds. Only a handful of countries has agreed to recognize undivided Al-Quds as the Israeli regime's capital, a recognition that forestalls final stall negotiations. Trump symbolically acquiesces in Netanyahu's claims. Biden, let the symbolism stand. Although Israelis often attempt to use the 1947 UN General Assembly partition plan as a charter of legitimacy, it isn't. It was never ratified by the UN executive branch, which is the Security Council, and so has no force of law. Moreover, Israeli regime leaders such as Ben-Gurion only paid lip service to it, ignoring it when they could seize further territory by main force. But even that very pro-Zionist 1947 plan did not award Al-Quds to Israeli regime, the city given its importance to Jews, Christians and Muslims, was to be under an international regime. But in 1948 war, the Zionist regime captured the west of the city, while Jordanian troops held the east. The Israelis annexed East Al-Quds and other Palestinian West Bank territory, which is an egregious violation of the United Nations Charter, which forbids the acquisition of territory by military force. The Zionist regime is a signatory. Then, the Zionist regime began flooding Israeli squatters onto Palestinian land in East Al-Quds. This transfer of population from the occupying power to militarily occupied territory is a severe violation of 1949 Geneva Convention on the Treatment of Occupied Populations. The Fourth Geneva Convention was aimed at preventing a repeat of Axis war crimes, as with the attempts of the Nazis to settle occupied Poland with ethnic Germans and to ethnically cleanse Poles from their own country to make way for Germanization. Today, 370,000 Palestinians live in East Al-Quds, and Israelis have managed to plant over 200,000 Israelis in squatter settlements on land owned by Palestinians. The goal of the Israeli regime, right, is to evict the Palestinians slowly and gradually so as to avoid a backlash from the rest of the world and to replace them with Israeli settlers so as to create a monochrome Israeli Al-Quds. Currently, the Palestinian neighborhoods in East Al-Quds and being turned into cantons surrounded by Israeli squatter settlements and sometimes cut off from other Palestinians, and they're all heavily surveilled and patrolled by Israeli regime forces. The Biden administration gives lip service to a negotiated settlement, but Washington has done nothing at all to prevent the gradual colonization of the Palestinian West Bank, including East Al-Quds, by Israelis over the past for the 54 years, and so we'll just go only sending over memos.
The debate.
Israeli forces continue their attacks on Palestinians in and around Jerusalem Al-Quds. Meanwhile, Israel has attacked the besieged Gaza Strip. Over 40 air raids have resulted in 28 deaths, but the Palestinian resistance groups like Hamas have fired hundreds of rockets into Israel, breaking the defense shield, killing two Israelis, and for some of the rocket fire to have even reached Tel Aviv. In this edition of The Debate, we will look at this exchange of fire between Israel and the Gaza Strip, and how Israel remains vulnerable to rocket attacks from the Gaza Strip while trying to find out if there is a solution to this conflict. First, let's find out what is going on in Gaza. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon joins us from Gaza City. Ashraf, at this point, when we spoke last, it was during a time where there was an exchange of fire. Not exchange of fire, there was a barrage of rockets coming from the Gaza Strip. And that's not a scene that is seen quite often, but it was quite incredible. What happened at that time when we were speaking to put us up to speed as to what occurred there?
Yes, the Hamas's military wing, the Zin Qassam Brigades, at that time was retaliating to Israel's bombing and destruction of a 13-story residential tower west of Gaza City by firing nearly 200 rockets, most of them towards Tel Aviv. Hamas has earlier warned that if Israel destroys a residential tower, it will respond by hitting Tel Aviv, and Hamas has fulfilled its threat or promise. Since this Israeli aggression on Gaza, the Israeli regime forces have killed 28 Palestinians in Gaza, including 10 children, and injured close to 160 people. The situation is only getting more tense and more and much worse by the minute, as it's very likely that the Israeli regime will respond in a very tough way to the attacks or retaliatory rockets by Hamas. According to Israeli media, what happened tonight is the worst ever missile attack against the Israeli regime ever since its creation.
Okay, thank you for that. We appreciate it. From Gaza City, Ashraf Shannon, a correspondent there, I'm sure he'll be talking to us more about what is going on there. Let me bring in our guest for this edition of The Debate, journalist and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mustafa joins us from Algiers. And we have Rania Masri joining us, Lebanon's Citizens in a State Party, she's a member of, and she joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. I'd like to welcome you both. Rania Masri, our correspondent, talked about the tower that was leveled. It was a 13-story tower that brought about a reaction from you, as I noted there on your Twitter post, a 13-story residential tower to have destroyed destroyed hit with precision airstrike, as you wrote, by Israel during Iftar, a war crime, as you stated. Gave you that initiative to actually have that post or have that action bring about a reaction from you?
Well, it is a war crime in all simplicity. When you have precision targeting a residential tower during Iftar, so we can imagine 13 stories of a residential tower, we can imagine how many apartments are in those stories, how many families are gathered together to share their meal together, how many hundreds of people could be in that building, and the entire tower was destroyed. So we need to recognize this for what it is. It is a war crime, and these are war crimes that the Israeli state has been inflicting on the Palestinians since 1948, and we need to use our words very precisely. It saddens me to hear this expression, exchange of fire, being used on Press TV. What's used on Press TV is much better than what was used on the New York Times or the Guardian or the Reuters or other press agencies. But let us be very accurate. We do not have an exchange of fire. We do not have retaliation from the Israeli state. We have an ongoing crime of ethnic cleansing, an ongoing act of settler colonialism, an ongoing act of apartheid. One of the world's strongest militaries, supported by either directly the United States and Europe or England, or the silence of the other countries of the world, attacking a besieged, oppressed population that is hand-making their rockets. This is not an exchange of gunfire. This is the Palestinian stance of resistance, of survival, against a brutality that continues to exceed our expectations.
Based on that description, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, that our guest there made, which was very descriptive, and which I will refrain from using some of the terms that he said should not be used, and pass on the message. Maybe there's a different ball game now. I mean, I'm not asking for military analysis from you, but I'm asking whether what we saw, which reached Tel Aviv in terms of this military rockets that are being fired, which leaves no choice for the Palestinians except for Hamas and his factions to do that, because nobody else is coming to the rescue of Palestinians, really, after what happened in Jerusalem al-Quds. Do you think that'll change the calculations of Israel in any shape or form?
I think so, yes. I mean, already we've seen that the Palestinian people have shown incredible defiance by already returning to al-Aqsa the following day from when they erupted, when the Israeli army erupted inside the place of worship and entered and violently abused worshippers. And yet, despite that, the reaction from the Palestinian people was to return and to say, here we are, we're still here. So I think that the more the Israelis push the Palestinians, the more they're saying, we're still here, we're not going anywhere, and we're going to resist whatever means we have. Now, of course, it's heartbreaking to watch, because we are seeing, as Rania Masri said, this is an incredibly well-armed people, an army, which gets $4 billion a year in aid from the U.S. and all sorts of advantages to attack a population that has no army, no fleet, no naval fleet, no air force. Here they are resisting with the very, very little means, and yet they're still here, and yet they're still resisting, and yet they're still telling Israelis that they're going nowhere, and they're going to have to deal with them. So the fact that they've reached Tel Aviv, and even though, I don't think that the number of victims are going to be very high, unfortunately, even though I think it would be fair to see that on the Israeli side, they should be experiencing what the Palestinians are experiencing. But I think despite that, I think symbolically to reach Tel Aviv in this way is a very good turn of events. And I think it is showing the Israeli side that the Palestinians are still there, they're still resisting. And it's a good point.
Well, Rania Masri, before we have any numbers being added to the number of dead at this point, it's up to 10 children involved. You would expect that there's got to be some kind of reaction to come through that would spell some kind of action to prevent what is happening. Aside from the rocket fire that's coming from the Gaza Strip, but we're not seeing anything except for maybe Egypt to have come out saying we tried talking to Israel or talking to Hamas and the factions. They're not interested in any talks at this point. What can be done to stop what is happening for this to continue, which will end up with more deaths and probably a lot more on the Palestinian side?
If you would allow me, before I answer your question, I just want to completely agree with what your guest said, and to add on to that, that we not only are seeing the amazing strength of a homegrown resistance in Gaza, but we are also seeing all of Palestine resisting, all of Palestine, 1948 Palestine, 1967 Palestine, all of Palestine. We saw this yesterday in marvelous images from Alid, from Nasra, from Tarshish, from other areas in 1948 Palestine. These are areas that have been occupied and oppressed and dispossessed by the Israeli regime for 73 years, and they are still rallying in support of the Palestinian flag and in support of their brethren in Jerusalem. So we are seeing something powerful here, not simply the physical resistance through the rockets, but the magnificent popular resistance throughout the land of Palestine. Hopefully we are seeing a third intifada, and hopefully that this third intifada throughout the land of Palestine will not only show the marvelous resilience of the Palestinian people, but will push the Palestinian people to dismantle the Palestinian Authority, which is one of the challenges, unfortunately, within the occupied lands of Palestine for the liberation, because the Palestinian Authority is still maintaining its security coordination with the apartheid settler state of Israel. Now, as to your other question, what can we do? Well, yes, we're not expecting much from the Egyptian government. We're not expecting much from any of the Arab governments. But we have seen wonderful protests erupt throughout the Arab region. We've also seen protests of solidarity erupt throughout the world. What we do need, and this is a very strong call issued by the Palestinians for decades now from the land of Palestine, what we do need for anyone who is outraged at this continuous crimes of brutality against the Palestinians, stand in support of the Palestinian boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Make it ring loud and clear. Support the BDS movement wherever you are. If you are in the United States, there's a particular bill that you could be supporting right now in the United States, which is a bill being presented by Representative Betty McCollum. She introduced a bill to prohibit U.S. taxpayers' dollars from funding the abuse of Palestinian children
This is unheard of in the U.S. Congress. It's Bill H.R. 2590. It's very mild, but nevertheless, it is revolutionary in the United States. We need to be doing what the Palestinians are doing, letting the people lead, so long as our governments are incompetent. The Palestinians are leading, not the Palestinian Authority. Let us, the progressive people of the world, also lead our governments into the light instead of simply sitting back and allowing these atrocities to continue under the headline of asking for calm from both sides. I do not ask for calm. I ask for liberation and equality.
Well, the liberation and equality is going to only come about if there's maybe in one respect a support that should be definitely evaluated and maybe directed, and that is coming from the U.S. For Israel. And Hafsa Kara Mustafa, in one of your interviews, you have said that Israel won't heed international law as long as it is under the U.S. aegis. Now, explain to us more and what it is that the U.S. is doing when it comes to Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians, and are we going to see anything that is going to put the issue of Palestine-Israel conflict on the radar of Joe Biden and his administration?
I think politically, we're not going to see much change. I think for the past 50 to 60 years, in fact, since the creation of the State of Israel, the U.S. has always had a very pro-Israel foreign policy, and it has become stronger and stronger with time. Perhaps there was a sort of a slight lull during the Carter years, but you know, since Reagan, it's been back, and it's a sort of love story that sees no end. However, what we're seeing, which is very, very interesting, it's with American society, I think there is very much a shift of mood amongst Americans who are more and more aware of what is happening. They're more and more questioning the narrative within their mainstream media that always portrays the Palestinians as the guilty party and the Israelis as the victims. And they're now, thanks to social media, thanks to various alternative media outlets, they're becoming very much aware of the situation in Palestine and therefore have a means of expressing their support and pressure on local politicians who are running for office. So whilst 10, 15 years ago, it was a given that supporting Israel was a vote winner, today, in some areas of the US, that's no longer the case. And that can have impact in the long term. Sadly, I think in the short term, there is still very much at the highest echelons of American politics an idea that the U.S. and Israel are tied together and that there's no really looking to sever the ties or at least sort of loosen them, mainly in terms of, for instance, the $4 billion that are donated to the U.S. every year. And I think if there was some change, at the very least on that point, we would see some light at the end of the tunnel. However, I'm afraid that's not likely to happen. And this is what gives Israel the sense of impunity, that whatever they do, whatever crimes they commit, they know that they have the absolute support of the most powerful nation on the planet.
Well, let's break open the third intifada, if we may, that you mentioned there, Rania Masri, for the liberation of Palestine. I mean, when you even have anything that comes close to that notion being either tweeted, as you mentioned in an article that was then suspended in one of the tweets that you had, how can this actually come about? Is that what we're seeing right now? Because you have a camp that says without a leader on the occupied territories, a third intifada is something that's not likely to happen. Do you agree with that?
Well, let us remember the first intifada and the second intifada did not have leaders. They were youth-led. They were led from the bottom up, led out of a sense of outrage and led out of a clarity of political vision. And later, they developed leaders. So in one sense, we do not need a leader for the third intifada. In another sense, one can argue that we do have a lot of leaders. We have the leaders who have come before us and who have shown the way, not only the martyred Ghassan Kanafani, but the martyred Basil al-Arash, who have presented a very clear path of resistance, the way that resistance needs to be multifactored, the way that it needs to be built on a number of different analyses. We carry the pen and we carry the sword. So if we look at what an intifada actually is, it's a popular movement, it's a youth-led movement, it's across all the territories, then yes, we are seeing the beginnings of a third intifada. Now, what is necessary for those of us who are not in Palestine, who are not in the Palestinian lands, the question for us becomes, how can we support the struggle for liberation? How can we support the struggle against apartheid? And here there are several things that we need to do. One, first and foremost, we must not allow any individual to be able to say the excuse of we did not know. We are getting video footage now from occupied Jerusalem that is showing the world what the Palestinians have been saying for decades about their home demolitions and about the settler state-supported violence. We are getting videos that show this. And just as the video of George Floyd caused the conviction of the U.S. policeman who murdered George Floyd and caused a resurgence of protest in the United States, the videos that come out of Palestine should make it clear that what Palestinians have been saying for decades is what we need to be listening to. We have those videos. We have the reports from Human Rights Watch, which is not in any way a radical organization. And Human Rights Watch recently stated that what is happening in Israel amounts to, and I quote, the crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution. We have these mainstream organizations that are finally agreeing to what Palestinians have been saying for decades. This can be the role of the people throughout the world to support the Palestinian struggle by making their voices heard, to support the Palestinian struggle by putting pressure on their governments wherever they can be, to support the Palestinian struggle by making sure that the narrative does not present this as a Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It is the occupation of Palestinian lands. It is a settler state colony. It is a racist apartheid regime. This is what people all around the world can be doing, and this is what is needed to be done, in addition, of course, to supporting the Palestinian liberation directly through whatever means possible.
A lot of things that Rania Masri says there, Afzakar Mustafa, are things that obviously if there were a lot more voices across the world, especially if it comes to officials, to be raised, then maybe we could get something rolling in order to get some motion into all the things that Rania Masri said. But what more could be telling than what we saw in the Gaza wars, where on our TV screens we saw the disproportionality of Israeli rocket fire killing people, Palestinians, right in front of our eyes. And we saw that through multiple wars. We have seen what's happening in the occupied territories in terms of the violations, report after report, and the most recent right now, perhaps some hope in the ICC investigation, though many are saying that's not going to amount to much. So a lot of it may be just a repetition, but in order to get a kind of movement going, when you even have social media posts that are being censored and filtered on different types of platforms, there's got to be more of a push somehow to get this the Palestinian cause known. What do you think? What direction should this go?
The problem we're facing here, and we've been facing it since the situation began, is that the mainstream media outlets are still very much in favor of the Israeli narrative, and therefore they have this means of imposing their position on public opinion. So I agree that there's a shift, and I think we can all recognize that. But overall, the reaction to the Palestinian struggle, to the Palestinian suffering, is just not the same. So when Rania Masri mentions George Floyd, for instance, it took this huge proportion because all media outlets took on that issue and talked about it, and it was acceptable for high-profile personalities, celebrities, to talk about it and to condemn it and to join in the condemnation, which then led public opinion across the world to join these mass protests. To this day, if you look at carefully, you have very, very few high-profile people, celebrities, who are actually posting about the Palestinian issue. And those very few who do, for instance, then get attacked and get pylons on Twitter and social media for doing that. And so it remains the Palestinian cause, even though it's blatantly a war crime that is committed against an unarmed population, even though we're seeing apartheid, just as we saw 30 years ago against the black population of South Africa. Despite all of that, it still remains a very contentious point because the mainstream media and the mainstream and the Western elites have still made it out to be they're still pushing the pro-Israel narrative, which means that it's a very touchy subject, and it doesn't allow this sort of mass movement to rise in favor of the Palestinian cause and actually pressure politicians in an effective way, in a way, for instance, that it was possible with the Black Lives Matter movement, with George Floyd, etc. So I think, again, even though we now have the option of social media and we now have YouTubes and all the rest of it, and people are far more informed, I think we're still today, in 2021, we're still in a world where the information is dominated by the mainstream outlets, and they're still dominating the narrative, which is therefore not having the impact that we'd love for it to have on the Palestinian cause.
Right, Ambassador, some U.S. lawmakers are very sympathetic towards the Palestinian cause, and they have voiced their concern, they have voiced their worry through one way or another, whatever channels they have used. Can you expand a little bit more for us on that and tell us if that's where hope may lie, at least in terms of them highlighting this, perhaps to make a difference in the way that the U.S. deals with Israel?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question? Who has been...
the U.S. lawmakers. There's been a number of them who are who have voiced their sympathy towards the Palestinians. Maybe is that a solution there, that from the American side, from within the Congress, halls of Congress, for U.S. lawmakers perhaps make a difference here?
The solution ultimately will come from the Palestinians themselves within the land of Palestine. Liberation will come from within Palestine. Support for that liberation comes from outside. And yes, we have been seeing more voices in the U.S. Congress than we've seen before. We have a handful of representatives in Congress that are speaking out in support of Palestinians, be they Representative Rashida Tlaib or Representative Ilhan Omar or a few others. And of course, the representative that I brought up earlier, Representative Betty McCollum, who has approximately 18 co-sponsors on H.R. Bill 2590. And H.R. Bill 2590 simply asks for aid to Israel to be conditioned. I mean, simply asks for conditioning the aid. So yes, within Congress right now, we do have a greater space than we have had decades earlier. But let us also make very clear that the difference between Trump and Biden is a very dangerous difference, because President Biden is simply a more eloquent version of President Trump, which, of course, it doesn't say much about Trump, but it says a great deal for people who want to accept the very dangerous narrative of two sides. I think what's critical for people to understand is, and I agree with your guest, that yes, we are not where we need to be on the Palestinian narrative. We have shifted the narrative a lot in the past few decades than where it used to be earlier, but we are still not where we need to be. And this is why it becomes absolutely fundamental for every individual out there, every individual who believes in the validity of the struggle for justice and the struggle against apartheid within the land of Palestine, not to be a spectator to these war crimes. We cannot afford to be spectators. Here is my call to support the BDS movement. Here is my call to organize wherever you are, and my call to my fellow Arabs wherever you are, that we can see that despite the normalization efforts, despite the very disgusting military agreements that have erupted between the UAE and others and the Zionist state of Israel, we are still seeing unity coming out from the people of the Arab world, and that is why we recognize that liberation for Palestine goes hand in hand with the democratic movement in the region.
Thank you. Sorry to have jumped in. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, journalist and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mustafa. Pleasure. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mika Batapwe, entire team here in the Capitol, to everyone, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Alhamdulillah, we're making some good progress in reading from this book and sharing with you some of the vital points that Ayatollah Sheikh Jawadi Amuli makes. And inshallah, we will all be able to benefit as much as we can. We're still on the topic of how a person deals with their kin. And at the moment, we're talking about your immediate kin. So we spoke about parents, and now we're going to speak about children. The Islamic way of looking at children is they are like an amana. They have been entrusted to us. We need to make sure that we pay attention to their health. We pay attention to the environment that they are going to grow up in. We pay attention to their education. And we pay attention to their tarbiyah, to their upbringing. And I believe shaitani kind of misconception in some people's mind where they say, well, we don't want to have children because this world is very polluted and we hate this world and it's very ugly and I don't want to bring an innocent child into this world. What kind of mentality is that? You don't need to pollute your child. You can be a good example. You can be someone that is going to change that equation. And that's why there's all this encouraging of women having children and giving birth. Yes, you could probably say, well, it's easy for you men to say, but we, us men, will never be able to have that level of reward that women have, not only during the time of pregnancy, not only during the time of delivery of a child, but throughout the whole process of motherhood as well. The hadith says that one push, one talqa, as the hadith says, one push during the time of a mother delivering her baby is equal to the wiping off of her slate of a'mal and her sins. Like as if she herself, once she delivers the child, like as if she herself is also a newborn person. That's a blessed opportunity. That's a wonderful opportunity. Hadith says from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, it says, إِذَا حَمَلَتِ الْمَرْأَةُ, if a woman was to become pregnant, كَانَتْ بِمَنْزِلَةِ الصَّائِمِ الْقَائِمِ الْمُجَاهِدِ بِنَفْسِهِ وَمَالِهِ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. If a woman is pregnant, she is like as if it is someone who is fasting, who is praying, who is doing jihad fi sabilillah with them, with their self and with their money doing jihad. And if she was to deliver the child, she would have kana laha min al-ajr ma la yadri ahadun ma huwa li'azamatihi. If she was have to have the child, the reward that she has is someone that nobody is able to conceive and understand. فَإِذَا أَرْضَعَتْ كَانَ لَهَا. And this beautiful hadith that explains all of the details of how rewarding